Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio. My name is Keith Pennell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli, and today we have a guest talking about allergies. It's amazing just these days how many people seem to be suffering from allergies. I didn't suffer from allergies for many, many years, and all of a sudden something came into the air. I don't know what it was, but Russ, who's our guest today going to talk about allergies?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Zubair Mulla. He's at Texas Tech University at the Health Sciences Center in the School of Medicine. And it's not just allergies he's talking about. It's specifically food allergies, which one of my grandsons is a victim of. Welcome to Science Studio, Zubair.
Thank you.
How did you become what you are? How did you get into a career in science and medicine?
I've always been interested in health. Dad's a physician. And from a young age, I was thinking maybe medicine. Turned out I never applied to medical school. And I've been practicing epidemiology since I was 24 when I got my master's in epidemiology. So I'm a public health detective. And it's a fascinating field. I get to combine a little bit of biology every day with a little bit of statistical analysis and a little bit of dealing with others, talking with patients, et cetera, trying to hunt down what caused an illness, why one, say, group is having a higher rate of a disease than another, are rates going up or down over time, and why, say, this country has a higher rate of this disease than the other. So we're looking at diseases and how they distribute across person, place, and time.
So really, you're an epidemiologist.
Correct,
That's the sort of appropriate title.
Yes, sir.
Right.
Yep.
So then what got you into epidemiology? I mean, okay, so you're always interested in health, and Russ and I certainly are, at least our own. What made you think epidemiology was the way to go as opposed to focusing on a particular disease and doing research into Alzheimer's or Huntington's or whatever?
I'd finished up my BA in biology at Arizona and Tucson, and I'd moved back to Phoenix, and I was getting on my parents' nerves. I think I would just they wanted me to do something productive, so I was looking at graduate.
Anything, do anything.
That's right. Get this guy back out. I was looking at graduate degree programs, and the word epidemiology caught my eye, and I told my father the next morning, oh, I'd like to be an epidemiologist. He kind of smiled and said, do you know what they do? Where, you know, how do you get trained? I said, no. So he sent me to the library. I got a book called Medical Detectives, and it's just full of case reports. You might have read about it by a journalist, and I was fascinated. So I wanted to be an infectious disease epidemiologist, work up these outbreaks, and eventually move to Florida.
So your father said, an excellent opportunity in Florida, not Arizona, but you know, Wisconsin.
That's right. No. Yeah, he's very supportive, actually, and he actually had me interview a few epidemiologists with the Arizona Department of State Health Services. So I got an idea this is what I wanted to do. And off I went to Tampa and got my master's and doctorate in public health with a concentration in epidemiology. And I loved it a lot. Ended up spending about 10 years in Florida. I thought I'd just get my master's, my MS, and maybe go back to Phoenix and be a shoe leather epidemiologist, pounding the pavement, working up outbreaks of diarrhea, West Nile, whatever. But I ended up working as a cancer epidemiologist, worked a few years as a Florida Department of Health epidemiologist, and last 8.5 years been here in El Paso, in lovely Sun City, being an academic epidemiologist.
That's interesting because I remember reading articles where they talk about hotspots of outbreaks of cancer. You know, you get these maps of the U.S. and you'll find this one little spot, and I don't know where they will be, but with extremely high rates of some form of cancers and other things also. And then people say, there must be something specific about what's going on there, like a foundry or some source of nasty chemicals causing problems. But then statisticians will say, hey, but wait a minute. They're supposed to be hotspots, just the way the statistical analysis of data comes out. So just because you have a hotspot does not necessarily mean that the area you're in is particularly dangerous for you. Could you address that for a little?
Correct. So when I was a cancer epidemiologist at a University Cancer Center in Tampa, and then when I moved to Orlando and joined the State Health Department, I would get these phone calls from a worried parent. You know, my child has acute lymphocytic leukemia. And we were sitting in the doctor's waiting room. I started talking to other parents, and I think there's a cluster of cancer in my neighborhood. And as you mentioned, most clusters are not anything out of the ordinary in terms of an environmental point source or hazard, like, oh, there's a smoking gun. There's a factory XYZ with the pipe in the back, you know, oozing green glowing liquid. So you might have a cluster, might be even statistically interesting, but most of those clusters we found were never linked to any environmental point source. That just you might have a group of individuals with just common tumors of old age and bad behaviors, as I call them. You know, maybe the older you get, more cancer,
But it is a statistically appropriate sort of result to have clusters.
Yeah, I think sometimes you will find them. But again, then taking it to the next step, bringing in the chemist, the industrial hygienist, and trying to find a link or environmental causes, that I think link has been rarely found that, you know, the power lines or a factory. But we will see clusters.
Yeah, but what if there's another factor in there too, which is class action lawyers who tried to get groups of people together to get money out of somebody. Have you found that?
Yeah, no, I've had to sometimes deal with attorneys at the health department, but, you know, we try to do our part, which is the public health biostatistics epidemiology angle, and that's as much as I would be involved with, maybe kind of do a kind of armchair analysis. We call up the state tumor registry, you know, hey, how many cases did we have, massage the numbers, you know, for the age distribution of the population. Is it a retirement community? And you're going to expect to see a lot of breast cancer and lung, but, and then, you know, if it goes to the next level, we bring in maybe environmental health science professionals.
But your current interest really is organisms or things that get here somehow, or genetics?
Well, currently, I'm focusing on women's health epidemiology, and the side interest for about the last 5 years has been allergies and specifically anaphylaxis. So I'm with obstetrics and gynecology looking at things like women with diabetes when they're pregnant or high blood pressure, say preeclampsia. I went to a conference about 6 years ago, an allergy conference. So a bunch of allergy physicians running around and immunologists, met a gentleman who was an allergist up in Michigan. And he said, you know, I need an epidemiologist to collaborate with. Are you interested? So I said, I've never worked in allergies. And over the years, we've ended up publishing about 4 or 5 papers on anaphylaxis and looking at various issues like stinging insects and food.
Well, let's,
and meds.
Before we get into the details of the study and the results, just explain to the audience anaphylaxis. What is this? I mean, we all know anaphylactic shock. Tell us exactly what really is this problem.
Sure. So a simple definition of anaphylaxis, it's a serious allergic reaction that is rapid in onset and may be fatal. And just that's plain and simple.
I mean, what's it caused by, though? There's a reaction and then your body pumps in lots of adrenaline or?
So there's several types. There's IgE-mediated and non-IgE-mediated. So we have some immunology terms there.
No one has a clue what IgE is.
Okay. Well, our body has these cells called mast cells, M-A-S-T. Mast cells, and in those mast cells, there's these little bags or granules containing histamine and other inflammatory mediators. And so let's say a child's been sensitized to peanut, and he's developed a type of antibody known as IgE, and the next time the body maybe sees peanut, it might have a rapid reaction. What happens is that IgE hangs out and docks with that mast cell, kind of binds with it. And then you have maybe an allergen, say the peanut allergen. And eventually, long story short, that interacts with that antibody and the mast cell, and this mast cell spits out or has a degranulation of the histamine, and all of a sudden you might start having breathing trouble, vomiting, diarrhea, and maybe anaphylactic shock, as Keith mentioned, a drop in the blood pressure.
Yeah, anaphylactic shock. It covers a range of things, you hear about people whose throat swells up and they can hardly breathe or swallow.
Right.
Is that typical of anaphylactic shock, or can you have other symptoms and not have this swelling response?
It's a very good question, and the answer is yes. So the most common target organ systems, the body systems that are involved in anaphylaxis, in descending order would be skin, then the respiratory breathing tract, the gastrointestinal, your stomach and intestines, and maybe the heart. So it's possible you don't have that throat swelling and your breathing trouble, but you have a drop in blood pressure and then vomiting. So everyone seems to know a family with a child that has maybe a peanut allergy, that child would have an anaphylactic reaction to food. And we think of, again, the throat swelling and the breathing and mom looking for the EpiPen, the epinephrine injector. But you can also have a drop in blood pressure and diarrhea and vomiting. And so usually with anaphylaxis, you have maybe two or more body organ systems involved, again, like gastrointestinal and blood pressure.
But at the beginning, you said there was a series of, and you mentioned the skin first.
Right.
So is that one of the more mild? I mean, I know if I take iodine, I get a little rash. It's not a big deal. But, I mean, I know it's there. I don't worry about it. Perhaps I should. But so is that the skin is usually the first responder?
Yes, it is. You might have itching, hives, a redness. In the mouth, you have also itching. I remember reading a case report of a child, a two-year-old. He was eating nuts with his father. Two-year-old had no problems, no asthma, no known allergies. The child immediately spit out the nut, complained to his dad, you know, my tongue hurts, and vomited, and eventually was diagnosed with anaphylaxis, and that child unfortunately expired. So you might have a burning.
You mean just
from
that,
one?
Yes, yes, yeah. That's case report reported by a physician and his colleagues. So just to illustrate the dramatic effect that you don't always have. Maybe,
you mean like, I mean expired within minutes?
Yes, yes. They didn't recognize it as anaphylaxis, and
you know, one of the things that I've learned about this in preparing is that there are different nuts. I have a grandson that's allergic to tree nuts, but not peanuts. So it can be very tricky what specific thing will cause this.
That's true. And we've seen an increase in self-reported peanut allergy in the United States. So the prevalence has tripled between 1997 and 2008.
So this is where your epidemiology comes
in. Exactly. Numbers and biology, right, and mashing
and
it all
together. It's not just that more people are sort of thinking about peanuts now. I mean, I never thought about a peanut other than something to eat with beer.
Yeah, I'd like to have a bag right now, tell you the truth.
It could be better detection, as you mentioned, just better case definitions. The problem with anaphylaxis epidemiology is that no one seems to be able to agree on what is anaphylaxis. So that for many years, it was hard to do some bean counting because we didn't have a definition. Like, you know, do we have to have a drop in blood pressure and the hives, or hives, drop in blood pressure and, say, the itchy red mouth? And so finally, some groups have gotten together, professional groups of allergists and allergy researchers, and they're finally settling on it so we can count and get the incidence.
Well, you go back to saying that there are more cases of peanut allergies. Why? Are we selling more peanuts? Is that the reason, or is it something else?
That is a mystery. I think we're still working on that, why it's tripled. It's still a low rate compared to, say, other chronic illnesses. So the tripling went from, say, 0.4% up to 1.4% between 1997 and 2008. So it's tripled, but you might say, you know, 1% of Americans have peanut allergy. These are actually statistics for children under 18 years of age.
You mean 1.5 children out of 100 or 1.5 people out of 100?
1.4% of children under 18.
Okay, right.
Sorry, so 0 to, say, 17. I don't know why it's going up. That's a good question. There's some talk about the hygiene hypothesis. Has America gotten too clean, and our kids are not, you know, eating enough of a little bit of dirt and getting exposed?
Well, let's talk about that. You have children?
Well, yeah, sure. That implies that, you can build your immunities.
Right. Are you a worrying parent when your child is outdoors in the dirt? Do you sort of say, hey, try a little bit of this or try a little bit of that? Or do you say, ha, Charles, come inside?
I think I was one of the hyper-vigilant ones.
You were?
Yeah, we had no dogs or cats in the house, which maybe in hindsight, maybe some research shows maybe in the first year of life, if you do have, you know, Fido or, you know, a little cat there, it might actually protect against allergies later in life. So I'm not an immunologist, but I think there's a lot of work going on this hygiene hypothesis that we've kind of cleaned up too much.
Okay. Well, we have to clean up the first portion of this program. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in one moment with Science Studio.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. You may not be aware that epilepsy affects 1 in 100 Americans, making it a rather common brain disorder.
A contestant on American Idol was epileptic and had to wear dark glasses to keep the blinking lights from triggering an attack.
While some people respond well to treatment, a third don't, and for most epileptics, the cause of their seizures remains a mystery. Researchers are looking into a possible explanation.
Using a combination of genetic analysis, mathematical modeling, and microscopic imaging, scientists have identified millimeter-sized microlesions in the brains of 15 people who had surgery for their epilepsy.
Their brains had otherwise appeared normal. But in these microlesions, researchers found 11 groups of genes that either express too much or too little in brain tissues with high electrical activity.
Based on what these genes encoded, researchers predicted that compared with normal tissue, the microlesions would have more blood vessels and cells involved in inflammation.
To confirm their hunch, they stained sections of microlesions and put them under a microscope. Sure enough, they found inflammation and increased blood vessels. They also found neurons in these lesions had lost connections with one another, limiting the communication between them.
This may cause aberrant electrical signaling that triggers seizures in epileptics. The study needs more work, but may guide scientists to a new therapy to help the millions of people who suffer from disabling seizures daily.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back. This is Keith Pannell with Russ Chianelli and Zubin Mulla. And we're talking about epidemiology. In particular, we're talking about it with respect to allergies. And it's a fascinating area. A lot of people are reporting allergies these days. I mean, and I go back to my first sort of idea. Is that simply because people are beginning to think more about allergies as opposed to, like myself? I never thought of myself as having allergies, but I find myself at certain periods sneezing and teary-eyed. And I presume that's an allergy. I haven't reported it to anyone. I do nothing about it. But I'm more conscious of the concept that people do get allergies. Do you think that's part of this response of 0.4 to 1.4%?
It might be. I think what those statistics would be that I rattled off are self-reported, so maybe not validated by a physician. There might be just more vigilance and just more awareness. Like a lot of health conditions might see an uptick over time, but it could be in part due to just detecting it better.
So you're a detective.
Yes, sir.
You're an epidemiologist. And you hear of an outbreak. What's the process? Do you have a SWAT team that goes in there and starts swabbing everything and looking? How do you do the job? Give us a case history of something that you've been following yourself, how it began, what you did, and what was the outcome.
Great. So I was with the Florida Department of Health as a field epidemiologist, outbreak infectious disease epidemiologist. And we have like a roughly 9 or 10 step procedure. And the first job is to maybe validate or verify that you have actually a higher number of cases, that something's out of the ordinary. So I'm thinking back when I was in Orlando, Florida, there was an outbreak of salmonellosis linked to bean sprouts, as I believe. So some sort of mung bean sprouts, and I think salmonella or shigella. So the local health department will know, you know, this is how many cases I see every week reported from the various labs and hospitals. And 1 week we saw a large increase. And so the number of cases observed was higher than what we expected. You validate and verify those conditions. And then the next step is, much like a homicide detective, you try to find a common thread. You have maybe 10, 15 patients. They all have salmonella, diarrhea, et cetera. Where did you eat? Do you have children? Have you traveled recently? So we try to find a common thread among these cases. But just because, let's say, you find 50% of your patients had eaten at, say, Joe's restaurant down the street, doesn't necessarily mean that you can statistically implicate Joe's restaurant. It might just be a very popular restaurant. Had you grabbed 10 healthy people off the street and said, hey, where did you eat last week? Maybe the same proportion would say Joe's restaurant.
So, can you point to a case that was clear? That was where you said, here's the problem? Or are they all sort of ambiguous?
Well, sometimes we look for the outliers, the cases that just don't fit the profile. So this outbreak, I think, was eventually linked to raw, uncooked bean sprouts, maybe served in various Oriental restaurants in the Orlando area. And we try to look for the individual who has the condition but maybe doesn't recall eating it. And these are sometimes where you get the most information, kind of the outliers.
Yeah, I can see this sort of aspect of what you do, mm-hmm. because there you do have a point source, mm-hmm. and you can correct it, and therefore this is a public service, a public health service. But going back to your interest in allergies, I don't quite see how that same process works with allergies.
Yeah, it's a little more difficult. So I've just gotten into allergy research in the last 5 years, and what my colleagues and I have been doing, instead of maybe looking at the microscopic or the minor level, like just one patient at a time, we're looking more at the macro level and looking at state databases. So we've been getting hospital databases from Florida.
But you're talking about food allergies, then?
All types of anaphylaxis. So you can have anaphylaxis triggered by food, medications, stinging insects such as fire ants and bees. So
examinations? I mean, do people take a big response to going in for an exam?
Sometimes not.
That's an academic
topic. I think more patients need to probably be referred to an allergist who's a physician just specialized in allergy and immunology. I think a lot of primary care doctors do a good job. But, you know, if mom and dad's worried about Junior's allergy and maybe he vomits when you give him apple or apple with peanut butter, you need to maybe talk to your physician, and then they might refer you to a pediatrician or internist who's done an allergy training fellowship. So I've been mining several hospital data sets and death certificate data sets with my allergy colleagues. So I'm partnered with an allergist up at Wayne State University, Michael Simon, and also an allergist in New York, Robert Lynn. And what we've been doing the last few years is trying to look for trends and be the public health detective, but kind of at the armchair using some software in our office, trying to see, are men more affected than women? How about black versus white patients? Are the rates going up? And so we found some interesting things, and I'll eventually get to some of our Texas data. But a couple years ago, my colleague and I, Michael Simon, we obtained 1 year's worth of Florida hospital data. So these were people who were discharged, hospitalized for a variety of conditions in 2001. The data set had over 2 million records. I had that sitting on my hard drive. And through 2.3 million records, we combed through it using computer software and found 464 patients who had been hospitalized with a primary or principal discharge diagnosis of anaphylaxis, which again is just a serious allergic reaction that is quick and could be fatal, deadly. And we just looked through their records electronically, tried to find some trends, and found some interesting age differences. So, for example, patients who were less than 18 years of age, we found they were three times as likely to be hospitalized for anaphylaxis triggered by food versus the individuals who are 71 years and older. So young versus old, the young folks seem to be suffering more from anaphylaxis triggered by food rather than, say, medications or stinging insects. And we also found a trend that's been published before that women seem to have a higher risk of anaphylaxis after age 20. So when you're talking about young adults, say up to age 15 or 20, there's a male preponderance. The male incidence is higher of anaphylaxis than the female, but it reverses, flip-flops maybe from 20 years of age and beyond, and that's what we found with hospital data.
Give us the numbers on that. I mean, are we talking 80% versus 20%, or are we talking 45 versus 55, et cetera?
I don't have it at the tip of my tongue here, but the female rate maybe in the young adult age was, maybe I'm trying to think about twice the hospital discharge rate than the males. And they come back closer together again during the elderly years. But there was a female excess.
Right.
Yeah, I don't recall offhand. Overall, we found what we call a hospital discharge rate of about 3 cases per 100,000 Floridians. So we used the database, find how many people have anaphylaxis, and then divided it by the population of Florida. Mm-hmm. Luckily, it wasn't too fatal. We found 4 deaths. So 4 of those 464 individuals passed on in the hospital, unfortunately. So less than a 1% hospital mortality rate.
Yeah, but how many people in hospital die anyway, regardless of the disease? Was it any significantly different or less?
That's a good question. Maybe if I'll take it a little step further, we then followed up this study with a second study where we actually contacted the Office of Vital Statistics in Florida and said, can you give me your death certificates of Floridians who've died of anaphylaxis? So instead of just looking at hospital, you might die in the home, unfortunately. You know, maybe you got stung by hornets in your backyard and down you go in the backyard and you die in the ambulance on the way to hospital. So we got 10 years worth of death certificate data, 1996 to year 2005, again from Florida. And again, I'm fond of Florida because that's where I was a public health professional for about 7-8 years. We found 89 deaths. And the interesting thing we found was that men were more likely than women among these people who died of anaphylaxis. Men were more likely than women to have died from anaphylaxis triggered by stinging insects. So everyone had died of anaphylaxis, but we found this trend that was statistically significant that they had sting venom anaphylaxis more than the women.
Yeah, they're cutting the grass.
That's right.
It's amazing. I mean, there's so many ways of interpreting this. I always thought, you know, this business about more women from the hospital will say, if I have an anaphylaxis attack, I'm going to lay on the couch and see what happens. My wife is going to go to the hospital.
That's right. So maybe the missus is sending the men out to, honey, can you take down on that beehive out there. Yes. But yeah, maybe the men have occupations that take them out, you know, more into the, you know, the open.
I'd like to find out a little bit. You alluded to the fact that you were looking at racial variations. What did you find there, if anything, that's useful?
In the death certificate analysis, we didn't find a difference. Now, back to the Florida hospital study, we found when we compared the whites with just everyone else, so we lumped in the Asians and African Americans, white versus other race, the whites were more likely to have anaphylaxis hospitalization due to the, again, stinging insects. So everyone had anaphylaxis, but when we looked at white versus other, for some reason, the whites were twice as likely to be hospitalized for anaphylaxis due to venom rather than, say, food, medications, et cetera, X-ray contrast dye.
This is out of the 400.
Yes, exactly, the 464.
So, I mean, if you were to think about how many of those 400 were, say, African-American or Hispanic, I'm just wondering if there's a sociological feature here that they don't have health insurance to a larger extent because they're not quite as well off, et cetera, as Russ said.
That's a very good question. So we statistically adjusted for health insurance and also age. So after accounting for differences in age and health insurance, still the white folks in that data set were more likely to have this particular type of anaphylaxis.
Okay,
but more research is needed.
But again, in the white group, the males.
So male versus female, the males also had a higher risk.
Yeah.
And 36% more likely to have, again, the venom. So that's the hospital data set. It kind of agrees with the death certificate database that the men are out there somehow getting more exposed to stinging
insects. Hunt a lot more than women,
that's
I suppose.
Right.
And
yeah.
I mean, Florida is one of these places where you go out and hunt things.
Right. And there's some other issues now that is there more anaphylaxis in the north where there's less vitamin D, less sunshine. So vitamin D has this interesting role in immunology, again, which I'm not too familiar with. But so we've also tried to look at trends by, say, New York versus Florida, a sunny state versus not so sunny. And that's an area of research. Another area of research is moms. Pregnant moms. If mommy ate a lot of peanut butter during pregnancy, is she going to then put her baby at risk to grow up to have severe peanut allergy?
Any answer?
Well, there was a study that just came out last year, 2010. Another group of researchers from Mount Sinai School of Medicine, led by Scott Sicherer, those preliminary results seem to indicate that there is some positive correlation that if mom is eating peanut frequently, maybe two or more times a week during pregnancy rather than compared to women eating less, that those babies are having a lot of those IgE, as I mentioned, that antibody, they're having high-level IgE to peanut. So what does that mean, that the baby is having maybe is sensitized to peanut? That doesn't necessarily translate to clinical allergy. Just because you have a lab test that shows Junior might have a peanut allergy might not actually translate to, you know, the breathing trouble and anaphylaxis. But that result just looked at blood tests and then went back and epidemiologically looked at moms eating peanuts. So that's an area of research, and also the vitamin D is a big angle.
Okay, well, all you guys out there listening, see if your wife wants to cut the grass. And I think that's going to wrap the program up. Zuba, thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure.
Yes, thanks to Zubair Mulla, our guest. Please come back to Science Studio.
And thanks, Norma Martinez, for putting this together as usual. And we will be back next week with another riveting program. Bye-bye.